So in discussing confrontation, one has to both provide historical context as well as methodological assessment. The historical context was Vatican II, when the Catholic Church was revisiting some of their century and millennia old dogma, including their relationship with the Jewish people. And in the context of Vatican II, much discussion regarding so-called interfaith dialogue with the unstated and at times stated goal of revision on the part of both independent faith communities in the spirit of what was thought of as more harmonious coexistence was being contemplated. You'll see that's why at the end of confrontation, the Rav, as the chairman of the RCA Halachas Commission, whose word was inviolable, that's why the RCA came out with a public statement regarding the parameters of any so-called interfaith dialogue. The methodology is, to use a word in its literal sense, awesome. Kachi darka shel olam, kachi darka shel Torah, when it comes to complex questions of halacha and public policy, so you would expect maybe to begin with a Gemara, not that there's anything wrong with that, a line in the Shulchan Aruch. The Rav's position is rooted in ontological truths derived from the Chumash itself, not drashos, what he perceives to be deep truths at the very foundation of human existence, subsequently Jewish existence, then translated into halachic policy with very clear parameters. The Rav's confrontation guidelines continue to guide our community today. I follow them regularly. Our congregation happens to have a relationship with Kenny Harris's faith congregation, where we talk about issues as civil rights and human dignity, Tzelem Elokim, as the Rav says, that we not only may, but must, as people of faith, but never straying into the illicit territory of dogma and theology. The Rav begins by illustrating in Sefer Bereishis the triple confrontation, but before he moves to the specifically Jewish confrontation. Inter alia, you would see here that Rav Lichtenstein's position, which we discussed about the covenant, about the Bris Sinai be built on top of the Bris Noach, was also the Rav's position, and not the position of Rav Hutner. The first state of man's existence is as non-confronted being, simply as part of nature. And the Rav makes it clear that this does not necessarily only relate to man as a bestial or primal creature simply existing in the world, but even intelligent modern man, who's not aware of moral dilemma, who's not aware of his place outside of the regular nature, outside of the regular ecosystem, as it were, this is phase one of human development. Phase two, Vayitzav Hashem Elokim al Ha'adam Lemor, man is a confronted being, confronted by his creator, as distinct and apart from the rest of creation, somebody who has to make decisions of moral consequence And again, the Rav is very critical of modern man in terms of his capacity to discharge that obligation. And then the third level, the third phase, which is, of course, the interpersonal confrontation. Ula adam lo matza ezer kenegdo lo tov hayos ha'adam levado e'eselo ezer kenegdo. And here, too, the Rav was extremely critical of modern man's engagement with that confrontation, human beings confronting each other, and in particular, what's he critical of? The tendency, this will become his point of departure in terms of analyzing interfaith relationships, but Eitan, the tendency of people to try to dominate each other. People trying, and it's so resonant in today's political context, where instead of looking for consensus and compromise, you have this kind of a tribal war. And unfortunately, the Rav was able to discern almost some 60 years ago that there was a tendency to want to dominate. Modern man, who did not meet to the fullest the challenge of confrontation on the second level, meaning vis-a-vis the natural universe, does not perform well at the level of personal confrontation either. He has forgotten how to master the difficult dialectical art of Ezer Kenegdo, of being one with and at the same time different from his human confronter, of living in community and simultaneously in solitude. He has developed the habit of confronting his fellow man in a fashion similar to that which prevails at the level of subject-object relationship, seeking to dominate and subordinate him instead of communicating and communing with him. The wondrous personal confrontation of Adam and Eve is thus turned into an ugly attempt at depersonalization. Adam of today wants to appear as master hero and to subject Eve to his rule and dominion, be it ideological, religious, economic, or political. As a matter of fact, the divine curse addressed to Eve, "V'hu yimshol bach, he shall rule over thee," has found its fulfillment in our modern society. The warm personal relationship between two individuals has been supplanted by a formal subject-object relationship which manifests itself in a quest for power and supremacy. Ayin in Yana Diyoma, to see that as the source of terrible paralysis in this country. But then the Rav moves to a wholly different level, that the Jew is part of all of this, the confrontation with nature, the confrontation with other human beings, but a Jew who has a dual confrontation, because insofar as a Jew is and must be part of humanity at large, both in terms of our relationship with nature as well as in terms of our relationship with each other, a Jew has been separated to a degree regarding internal faith commitments from the rest of society. Those who were advocating the idea that the Jew should simply blend in, even if, as the Rav says, they profess to have a nostalgic sense of Jewish identity, what the Rav refers to as the philosophers of a single confrontation, that we could simply exist as part of humanity at large, we're neglecting and disregarding the ontological separateness of the Jew. The proponents of the single confrontation philosophy do not preach complete de-Judaization and unqualified assimilation. They also speak of Jewish identity, of Jewish selfhood, and the natural will for preservation of the Jewish community as a separate identity. As a matter of fact, quite often they speak with zeal and warmth about the past and future role of Judaism in the advancement of mankind and in its institutions. However, they completely fail to grasp the real nature and the full implications of a meaningful Jewish identity. And then the Rav goes on to say what that identity consists of. And it largely is rooted in the notions of Hafrasha and Havdalah. Hein am levadad yishkon, Uvagoyim lo yischashav. And he details, therefore, as he did at the level of the confrontation between Adam and Chava, what he perceives as now a macrocosmic iteration of the tendency to wish to dominate, that any interfaith dialogue misses the deep truth that two human beings are fundamentally different, and as such, two faith communities cannot just, so to speak, reconcile these fundamental and inalienable differences. Moreover, any attempt to do so will lead to one party, most likely the majority faith tradition, in this case Christianity or Catholicism, to seek to dominate, to subjugate the smaller faith community. Though the Rav says it would be equally inappropriate for us to dictate internal terms of dogma and theology to any other faith tradition. The logos, the word to which the Rav refers, is fundamentally non-translatable between different faith traditions. And then the Rav concludes with what he calls the fourth reason that any kind of dialogue surrounding matters of faith, theology, the role of the priest or the rabbi in the faith traditions, the reason that all of this is fundamentally inconceivable. Fourth, we certainly have not been authorized by our history, sanctified by the martyrdom of millions, to even hint to another faith community that we are mentally ready to revise historical attitudes, to trade favors pertaining to fundamental matters of faith, to reconcile some differences. Such a suggestion would be nothing but a betrayal of our great tradition and heritage, and would, furthermore, produce no practical benefits. Let us not forget that the community of the many, Christianity, will not be satisfied with half measures and compromises which are only indicative of a feeling of insecurity and inner emptiness. We cannot command the respect of our confronters by displaying a servile attitude. Only a candid, frank, and unequivocal policy reflecting unconditional commitment to our God can say, oh, well, maybe one can be three, and three can be one. A sense of dignity, pride, and inner joy in being what we are, believing with great passion in the ultimate truthfulness of our views, praying fervently for and expecting confidently the fulfillment of our eschatological vision when our faith will rise from particularity to universality, will impress the peers of the other faith community, among whom we have both adversaries and friends. He doesn't deny that there are people who are disposed in a very friendly way. But friendliness, as we discussed last week in a different context, is not grant one permission to dispense with truth. I hope and pray that our friends, and he considers them friends, people of good intention in the community of the many. Look at how sensitive and diplomatic his language is. He doesn't even refer by name. Will sustain their liberal convictions and humanitarian ideals by articulating their position on the right of the community of the few to live, create, and worship God in its own way, in freedom and with dignity. And here, even though the Rav did not write it explicitly, I cannot imagine he did not have in mind the example of the Reformation. As is well known, Martin Luther, who became the leading anti-Semite of his age, and many of his writings were deeply influential on Hitler, so Martin Luther started off as positively disposed to the Jews. One of his points of departure was that the church had been too harsh with the Jews, and his notion was that he was going to be able to entice and bring Jews over. After all, the Jews have a tradition of study. The Reformers, what became known as the Protestants, they were going to emphasize the role of study. Maybe there's some harmony here. We can work things out. We can concede a little bit on Jesus, and they can, I don't know, take on some of the halachos, and maybe we'll work it out somewhere in the middle. And when he saw that we were not prepared to compromise, so he became far more virulent in his anti-Semitism than the unreformed, as it were, church. What confrontation, of course, does is establish this, what we call dual confrontation. We have to remain completely separate and apart when it comes to our theological commitments and convictions. But we have not abandoned, as the Rav says, that other aspect of our being one, integrated fully with the human community. We are indeed, says the Rav, involved in the cultural endeavor, and yet we are committed to another dimension of experience. Our first patriarch, Abraham, already introduced himself in the following words, Ger v'toshav anochi machem. Is it possible to be both ger v'toshav at the same time? Is not this definition absurd, since it contravenes the central principle of classical logic that no cognitive judgment may contain two mutually exclusive terms? And yet the Jew of old defied this time-honored principle and did think of himself in contradictory terms. He knew well in what areas he could extend his full cooperation to his neighbors and act as a toshav, a resident, a sojourner, and at what point the gesture of cooperation and goodwill should terminate, and he must disengage as if he were a ger, a stranger. He knew in what enterprise to participate to the best of his ability, and what offers and suggestions, however attractive and tempting, to reject resolutely. Of course, the Rav notes that the areas of toshav are indeed many, and they are binding, and we have a responsibility, indeed a sacred obligation, the same obligation that requires us to distance ourselves from the universal human community when it comes to matters of ger, when it comes to matters of philosophy, when it comes to matters of theology, and dogma. We have an equal responsibility to engage in the critical humanitarian issues of the day. We reject the theory of a single confrontation and instead insist upon the indispensability of a double confrontation. First, as we have mentioned previously, we created in the image of God, Selam Elokim, are charged with responsibility for the great confrontation of man in the cosmos. That never went anywhere. Vayitzav Hashem Elokim al Hadam Limor, that continues to resonate within us. We stand with civilized society shoulder to shoulder against an order which defies us all. Second, as a charismatic faith community, we have to meet the challenge of confronting the general non-Jewish faith community. We are called upon to tell this community not only the story it already knows, that we are human beings committed to the general welfare and progress of mankind, that we are interested in combating disease, in alleviating human suffering, in protecting man's rights. This is 1964, civil rights. In helping the needy, poverty. This is the great society of Lyndon Johnson. But also what is still unknown to it, namely our otherness as a metaphysical community. Some 60 years ago, the battle that the Rav needed to wage on behalf of the halachic Weltanschauung was to remind Klal Yisrael that we were not only Toshav, but that we are Ger, and that we cannot engage in a debate, a so-called debate, a so-called dialogue, when it comes to matters of theology and dogma. Some 60 years on, the problem is in the opposite direction. And the Rav's grandson has articulated it very clearly. The problem is no longer that we have forgotten that we are ger, but the problem is that we have forgotten our responsibilities as a toshav to do those things regarding human suffering, combating disease, together with all of society. For the past months, within several of our communities, we have been confronted by a strange, dissonant reality. On the one hand, we are scrupulously observant, and yet on the other hand, shockingly contemptuous of the cardinal mitzvah, v'nishmarta me'od nafshoseichem. As multifariously evidenced, both on a collective communal level as well as a personal individual level, we are extraordinarily kind and compassionate, and yet we've been acting with extreme cruelty in transmitting a potentially lethal virus to each other, with predictably catastrophic consequences. Yesterday, the United States recorded 160,000 new COVID infections. Next week, over 1 million Americans are going to be infected with the coronavirus. Over 1 million Americans, 200,000 Americans a day will be infected. The hospital system is going to collapse. The mortality rates, which are already catastrophic, averaging 1,200, 1,300, 1,400 a day, will become multiples of that. We are committed to protecting the honor of heaven, and yet time and again, our contempt for public health measures has greatly profaned the honor of heaven. Who would have thought that such a contradiction, fraught scenario, could possibly exist? And yet, indisputably, this scenario prevails in several of our communities. Let us present and reflect upon one cause of this dissonant reality. As Rutursky goes on to say, we've developed a sense of protectiveness, a sense of rejectionism of much of what is around us, and particularly with increasing insularity over recent years. Our motivation is noble, but our actions are decidedly ignoble. The extreme Weltanschauung, with its intellectual xenophobia, embellishes the Torah's imperative of separateness. In embellishing, we diminish, undermine, and imperil kol hamosif goreya. There is equally vital halachic need, mekablen es ha'emes mimisha amaro, to accept truth from whoever speaks it. Rejection of societal culture must be discriminating because halacha is discriminating. While it unequivocally rejects that which is antithetical, it unabashedly welcomes and even seeks certain elements of chachma, even when they emanate from the outside world. Chachma bagayin ta'amein. Case in point, halacha recognizes, respects, and relies upon medical knowledge and opinion from the outside world. And yet, in clear and defensible violation of halacha, we have in several of our communities throughout the pandemic ignored and rejected medical science, its warnings and protocols. In so doing, we have acted against our own halachic principles, cruelly inflicted suffering and death upon ourselves, and betrayed our most sacred trust of kivod shamayim. And then he goes on to say, of course, that it's not just that we're ignoring Dr. Fauci or other highly qualified public health officials. There are certain Jewish communities where you say his name, it's like a klala. You know, people react as if, you know, there's something indecent about mentioning the man's name. It's a pella. Rutursky goes on from here. Al regel achas, the problem is the following. The Rav lived at a time where Jews were prepared to ignore the first part of Avram's axiom and to say, Toshav anochi imachem, but we are separate, we are a ger. And what's happening today is the opposite phenomenon. Jews are now prepared to ignore the second part of Avram's axiom and to say, not ger v'toshav anochi imachem, but exclusively ger anochi imachem, to ignore the Rav's mandate that we have as members of a universal community, all created b'tzelem Elokim, to be concerned with civil rights, with human dignity, and in this case, in a completely uncontroversial way, to do all that we can to stand shoulder to shoulder, to use the Rav's expression, to fight the burden of a terrible and horrible and raging pandemic. Ger v'toshav anochi imachem. This contradiction, seeming contradiction, was first articulated by Avraham Avinu, but it forms the basis of our ontology to this very day. We are both, indeed, separate and apart, hin am levadad yishkon, and fully integrated as toshavim, as members of a human community who recognize the catastrophic loss to Tzelem Elokim that we're experiencing. To put it in perspective, 250,000 of our fellow